Okay, welcome back. We're going to talk to a newcomer to the program, although I've known Ken Swartz for a long time, and I didn't know that I'd ever run into him again, but I did, and I'm glad to have him on the program to talk about MOXIE fusion, metal oxygen fusion. This is an important story that really nobody hears about. And I'm amazed at the amount of anonymity the whole profile somehow maintains. It's just not a topic that is talked about much. We're going to find out why. Hello, Ken. Welcome.
Oh, good to be on, Jeff.
The last time I'm not actually seeing you now, but the last time I saw you, I was trying to figure it out. 28 years?
Yeah, it was 29? Back with Jose Escamilla back in California.
Wonderful Jose Escamilla, a great UFO researcher, filmmaker, just a real visionary, wonderful guy. I miss Jose. But that was the time, and I had an opportunity to talk to Ken recently and realized that we had run into each other so long ago. So let's talk about MOXIE. Question number one, why is this not something that is commonly available to people, routinely talked about? Why is it pushed in the shadows? Is there a conspiracy here?
I think there is. It's, science is really turned into more of a tyrannical system where certain ideologies are promoted and others are suppressed. And, of course, industry and government have parts in this because, the existing order, the existing infrastructure is, they're investing in it, and they don't really like competition to their structures.
Of course. Yeah. So, okay. MOXIE infringes on what part of their egos? What's the big threat here? Let's just give a general thumbnail about what is MOXIE fusion, MOXIE fuel, and why does it threaten the powers that be?
Well, one of the things is MOXIE fusion, it's an easily achievable technology that any of your listeners could do if they were so inclined. So it doesn't take billions of dollars and, dozens of years like other fusion that you hear about on the news.
Right.
And but the key thing is MOXIE fusion allows the relatively easy synthesis of new metals. It's over unity, and so it's also useful for energy production.
Okay. Now, everything, there's so many claims about over unity. Whenever I hear the word, wait a minute. Okay, let's talk about over unity first. What over unity is, for all of you listening, is more energy out than energy in. Okay, you're getting a plus, a bonus. You're getting free, you call it free energy. So that's the deal. All right, let's take the over unity issue first. Is this really a generator of more out than in? Is it really?
Well, yes, actually, before I go any further, for those listening, you can go to any search engine and type in the words MOXIE fusion research gate. That's MOXY. FUSION, and then the word ResearchGate, and that'll take you to a downloadable PDF that you can download, and then that'll be really useful to follow this discussion, so you get kind of more understanding. Because I do this on a podcast with visuals.
We
and
have
also,
graphics.
There's enough information in that paper and the references to build your own MOXIE fusion reactor, which people have done.
All right, this is very interesting. So the idea here, it's MOXIE, M-O-X-Y, fusion, F-U-S-I-O-N, research gate. All right? Just go there, and you'll see MOXIE paper, CLO, 12 proofed, possible fusion signatures and dark lightning, and it goes on from there. Which paper would you suggest people pull up? The first one?
The one on MOXIE fusion. The lightning one is there's possible evidence of MOXIE fusion in lightning. They've recently discovered gamma rays being produced in and other high energy X-rays being produced in lightning strikes, and they don't really
I didn't know that's another new thing I didn't know about. Gamma rays produced by lightning. Huh.
Yes.
Okay. I didn't know. All right, MOXIE paper 12 proofed. Go ahead. That's right at the top. That's probably the easiest one. All right.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So, well, Yeah, well, the first really practical application of MOXIE fusion was by a couple of Japanese researchers, Osawa and Kushi, in like the late 1950s and 60s.
This goes back that far?
Even further, but that was really the first really high efficiency one.
Uh-huh.
And what they did is they came at it from the yin and the yang perspective. They saw like one side of the atomic chart was the yang. That's kind of like the male force that's giving away the energy. And then the yin force is absorbing it. And they saw that as like the halides and oxygen especially. And mm-hmm. basically their experiment was this. They took a sodium street lamp power supply, and they made like a kind of a unique ceramic bulb with a little quartz glass window. And they put the sodium in there, but they also put an equal amount of oxygen and pressurized it with argon gas. And then they turned it on. And, of course, they could see through the little quartz window kind of that yellowy-orange glow of the sodium street lamp, which all of us are familiar with.
Yeah.
But over a few hours, that yellow-orange glow turned to a purple glow. And that purple glow comes from potassium.
Right.
And so basically what they were doing is they were taking, you know, sodium, which has an atomic weight of 23, and oxygen, which has an atomic weight of 16, and they're fusing it into a new element, which has an atomic weight of 39, potassium. And they did it basically with just the power supply off a sodium street lamp.
So didn't take a huge jolt of AC electricity to do this.
No, it didn't, and it was very efficient. It was actually, they were saying that they could probably synthesize potassium almost commercially viable amounts. But the problem
right.
was that, you know, Japan was an occupied country, and this was a threat to industry, especially to the occupiers who were putting in, you know, basically those fission nuclear reactors, you know, like Fukushima that melted down. Those are basically
yeah.
nothing but, you know, submarine reactors that have been put on land. And, of course, that's a really bad design, and we all learned that in Fukushima. So they got suppressed.
Yeah, that was the Mark I BWR. And for all of you listening, tomorrow night, Yoshi will be here, Yoichi Shimatsu, to talk about the 12th anniversary, so to speak, of the Fukushima catastrophe. And we are all still being deluged with radioactive material. We just don't know it because we're not told about it by the mainstream media. Okay, go ahead, Ken. Sorry.
Yeah, and so that's basically what they did. They just got suppressed. And I had read about this decades before, right? And so I was in the right place with the right people.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to basically redo their experiment, a slight modification, and we confirmed Osawa and Kushi's discovery.
What were you trying to do when you went into this and recreated what they had done and came out with positive results? What was your goal at that time? What were you trying to do?
Well, actually, I was trying to produce a safe energy source for humanity because
okay.
it was really after, it was a couple years after Fukushima, right? And we
yep.
were all getting cooked by radiation, you know, 70%
yep.
of the songbirds on the coast where you live died. The baby
yep.
died. And
I know.
And yeah, it was, I mean, a total
yeah.
disaster. So what we did is we used deuterium, which is an isotope of hydrogen. And hydrogen is in the same atomic family as sodium. So it's got that
mm-hmm.
yang energy in their sense. We
yeah.
call the yin-yang thing that the Osawa and Kushi were talking about, we call that electronegativity in the West. So basically
mm-hmm.
we took deuterium and oxygen-16, and we used the MOXIE process with, you know, a pressurized argon atmosphere, and we fused it into fluoride-18, which is, fluoride-18 is unstable. Usually has to be the atomic weight of 19 to be stable. So it basically electron captured, took an electron from the shell and turned one of the protons into a neutron and became oxygen-16. And what happens there is it releases a burst of energy, in this case in the high X-ray band, and a neutrino. And so... And we basically, what we did is if you go to, if you went to page 16 in the PDF, you can see what we did is we used X-ray plates.
Okay.
Which are unaffected by electromagnetic radiations and other than high energy ones. And you can see when we didn't have everything set up perfectly. We could run that little electric spark the soliton in there, but the minute we had everything together, we turned it on. Within just moments, it totally blacked out an X-ray plate that you can see there. So it was putting out a pretty significant amount of energy. And like when we were doing third-party testing, and I've talked about the overunity, when we were doing third-party testing, we had to we actually had to bury like our reactor chamber in ice, because you know usually we could just run that thing without the fuel, and it would just do the electric spark could be in there, it could run for hours, never be anything. But the minute the fuel's in there, and we turned it on, it got so hot within seconds, the reactor chamber, the gas got too thin in the reactor chamber for the electric spark to keep working in. So to do our third party testing, which was done, and we can talk more about that, but it was done. We basically had to bury the thing in ice. And because the battery, you know, we actually ran it off a couple of small 12-volt batteries because, you know, if we plugged it in the wall, people were saying, oh, you're taking that power from the wall socket. So what we could do is we could actually calculate the amount, because they're rechargeable, right? So we could just check the voltage levels. So we could calculate the amount of energy the batteries had used. And then we could roughly calculate the amount of energy needed to melt all that ice. And it was a lot more energy in melting ice than came from the batteries.
I'm curious, how were you going to capture this emission of energy and turn it into useful energy to turn, propel, or cause something to rotate? How was it you're going to generate the energy? Was it going to come through? Was it going to come through a third party, so to speak, another device that's hooked onto this?
Yes, it would be. We were making a test-proof reactor. So what we wanted to do is prove that fusion was actually going on. So we made sure our electric spark was below 10,000 volts. And what we did is we had a multi-band spectral analyzer. It was a silver iodine crystal to detect radiation so we could see all the different frequencies. And so we could see the different frequencies because you got MOXIE fusion. You have the deuterium fusing with the oxygen into the fluoride 18 and then the oxygen 18. But also, like on the electrode, we were getting iron fusing with the oxygen to make new elements. And there was like several different MOXIE fusion processes going on in that time. And so we could see all the different spectral analysis, you know, of what those frequencies are being given out. Now, that there's another group that also recreated our experiment. And you can go to ResearchGate and look up there. They also published, because we put our paper up back in 2014, you know, when we first did this experiment. So it's been up there for a while. And we open sourced it at ResearchGate. Anybody can go in there and read this stuff, because we're not going to keep a secret. We didn't come up with MOXIE fusion. So we were just going to kind of open source it to the world. So this Scotra group, they put their paper up. It's called Experiments Demonstrating the Creation of Elements via Pulsed electric field in water and deuterinated water applications to the production of chlorine.
Okay.
And they actually did basically our experiment over, and they actually put a patent in. We also put a patent in for basically energy production and the synthesis of metals, whereas they put theirs in to make fluoride 18 for medical purposes. It was one of the uses of fluoride 18. It's radioactive, and they attach it to sugars. And then they inject in your bloodstream, and you know, cancers eat a lot of sugar, right?
Right.
So the fluoride.
So they can track it. I get it.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's a detector, and you could actually detect where cancer is in the body for oncology purposes. And, and so, yeah, we have no problem with that. They can definitely, if that's a good thing, because it's really hard. Now you have to get particle accelerators to make fluoride 18, and it's just hard to get it. But if you can make it through an easy MOXIE process, it'll make that detection method much more available and easy for people to do.
Okay. All right. So you've got this little reactor. How big is it when you say little? How big is it? Well, I know what a car battery looks like, but
I'm looking at one right now. It's in the box. We built a whole bunch of them, and we're giving away working overunity MOXIE fusion reactors to university and corporate partners. We just ship it to you. It's basically a plug and play, and you bring your own spectral analyzer. Oh, what the other thing is, the Scotra group, they did a detection differently. They didn't use a multi-band spectral analyzer. They used a glass bead detector, and a glass bead detector can detect elements, especially ionized ionic elements like fluoride. So basically, they had, you know, they're running their thing. There's nothing but, you know, basically heavy water and argon gas in their reactor. They turn it on, and then you see the appearance of fluoride. And that is 100% confirmation of fusion.
I got it.
So they were, even though they're a good, even though they're, you know, kind of our competitors, they're also third-party confirmation.
Well, they're validating your work. I get it. It's
exactly.
A complimentary
and the patent
thing.
Office, yeah, the patent office has been arguing and saying this is impossible, which they've, of course, crushed all Lenner low-energy nuclear fusion patents or, you know,
they
or
have.
Anything like that. Yeah,
that's
so
right.
That is something that, well, they can't really deny now. I mean, we did our own third-party verification with, you know, with TSA systems. They make this stuff for, you know, the airport detecting radiation at your airports. But that wasn't good enough for them. No, they wanted more. And so, well, the Scotia Group brought more. So we'll work together hoping to get patents for both of us or anybody else that puts up a MOXIE fusion reactor patent. You know, we'll work together to make this happen.
All right, just for fun, let's imagine that we have these ready to deploy for a single residence. Is that something you'd look for? Or are you looking for something to take care of a block of homes? Would this be a single household device at some point?
Yeah, you could do a single household device. You could do, you know, a block. You could do a train. You could do a boat. It's all that. In fact, you know, we're kind of jumping ahead, but I could tell. Let's go on a little bit more about it. I want to talk about, like, the soliton.
Go ahead.
Kind of like the physics behind it.
And, you know, soliton. That's S-O-L-I-T-O-N. Soliton. All right.
Yeah.
Oh, let me ask you a question. Okay. Ken, hold on.
Yeah.
Did you guys succeed, either you or the other group or both groups, in furthering Osawa and Cushy's discovery from the 50s?
Yeah, we confirmed
it. Did you take it further? Okay.
Yeah,
you confirmed.
We took it further, and we proved conclusively that it happened because we did the spectral analyzer. The Scotia Group did the actual detection of the elements. And, I mean, and it's easy to do, right? They just read our paper and the references and made their own MOXIE fusion reactor. So if any of your listeners download, you know, MOXIE fusion research gate, just download the PDF, read the paper, read the references, find out, get the references off online, and you can build your, understand the science, and you can build your own MOXIE fusion reactor. It's doable by, you know, basically our MOXIE fusion reactor was built in our basement.
Got it. Okay. All right. Go ahead. Tell us more then.
Yeah. Well, soliton is basically an electron smoke ring. It's like billions of electrons. And, you know, usually electrons, because they're all negatively charged, they repel each other. But because they're kind of flowing in this closed circuit, this electron smoke ring, they all stay together. And the guy that really confirmed, showed the soliton was a guy named Ken Shoulders, and the late Ken Shoulders. And this is back in 1999. And basically what he had, a vacuum chamber, and he would create solitons on one side of the vacuum chamber, and they would fly across the chamber, and they would hit metal plates on the other side. And what he found is when, you know, he fired the soliton just at a plain metal plate, there was nothing. You would just punch a little hole in it, and nothing would change. But when he fired the soliton at a metal plate that was covered with a metal oxide layer, when he examined it with X-ray spectroscopy, he discovered new elements that you might get if oxygen fused with aluminum. So he was basically doing the same thing Osawa Cushy was, whereas they were fusing sodium with oxygen. In this case, Ken Shoulders was fusing aluminum with oxygen and producing new elements.
Is that a simple aluminum oxide, or is it something that's not on the periodic table, new element? Okay.
Yeah, no, the soliton, that electron smoke ring, it hits the aluminum oxide layer, and it pulls in. What happens in that, or like an R thing, when it's going through, we have an atmosphere of argon, because when you use the pressurized argon, it increases the MOXIE fusion rate like 10,000 times.
Okay.
So the soliton would fly through the atmosphere in our chamber. It would, the electron smoke ring, it would pull in, you know, atomic cores of, you know, deuterium, oxygen, and argon. And the argon's the moderator. It's really important in this. And then, so on one outside, you have, you know, all the electrons spiraling in one direction. On the inside, you have the baryon cores spiraling in the other. And what really happens inside of a soliton, it creates super degenerate matter, far more degenerate than can be found in the core of any star. And because if you look at the core of any star, regular fuse, you know, that runs our sun, there's always like one electron to one proton. And that electron weighs 1/836 of a proton. Whereas in a soliton, you can have more by mass of electrons than you have of like the atomic cores, the baryonic cores. And so that's super degenerate matter that can't even, that cannot exist inside of a sun. And that's why it's millions or even billions of times easier to do MOXIE fusion than conventional hydrogen isotope fusion. And basically what happens is that photon goes through our atmosphere or through Ken Scholder's vacuum chamber. When it impacts the anode of the other side or certain structures, it compresses. And when it compresses, it squeezes those atomic cores really close together, so close together that they can fuse together. And it basically lowers the Coulomb barrier. That's the energy it takes to fuse atomic, you know, nuclei, and fusion happens. So I think if you really want to think about MOXIE fusion as a physicist out there, it's kind of like, it's very similar to muon fusion, but a lot easier to achieve.
Okay. This is hard for some of our listeners and for all of you out there. We don't have pictures, so it makes it more difficult, but let me try and dial it back just a little bit. Is one of these reactors a MOXIE reactor, MOXIE fusion reactor? It's small. It's about the size of what? A car battery? Two car batteries? How small can you make them?
You can make them small. I mean, if you wanted to, we can talk about Stanley Meyer a little bit later.
I want to get there. Now, Stanley Meyer, some of you will right away, you'll have a ding. I know who that is. But don't forget about that name because we're going to get back to it. He's the guy that basically said he took tap water and was able to put it in his dune buggy with a combustion engine and power it. So this is all related to something we're going to get to. So hang on, because Stanley Meyer was a very interesting character. Back in a minute with Ken Swartz. Okay, welcome back. A little science in the first half an hour. We're going to move into something, another area that's really fascinating. I think most all of you know the word alchemy. Alchemy? I hope you do anyway. Alchemy is very interesting. Ken, define alchemy real simply for our listeners. How would you define it? I've got my own way, but I want to hear it from you.
Well, it's classically the turning of baser metals into precious metals, such classically gold.
Right.
So, you know, turning lead into gold or some other metals into gold. And the alchemists would go around and say that they could do this. But in history, there's really not a lot of evidence this was ever done until now.
All right. So we had, by the way, a soliton is a fixed wave, so to speak. It's not a machine or something. It's a wave. It's an energy
form. It's like a smoke ring of electrons that moves. And you know, my paper is basically MOXIE Fusion ResearchGate. That's where you get the download. It's basically a compilation of lots of people, seven examples of people over, well, in recent history who have actually did MOXIE Fusion-like processes. And the one where we could classic alchemy, which is like turning baser metals into gold. Well, back in 2004, Carrillo in Arono converted tungsten oxide into not only gold, but also rhenium. Those are both precious metals. And they also did an interesting thing. They did a MOXIE fusion fission process and produced the rare earth metals of thulium and europium. And as well as, and we knew that happened because, you know, beryllium was also produced. And beryllium is like the fourth lightest element, number four on the periodic chart. And it's only produced when there's fission, when larger atoms break down into smaller ones. And so if you go to page 30, you can actually see they basically had tungsten oxide electrodes. They ran like a massive amount of plasma electricity through them, created a plasma. And then when they examined them afterwards, they discovered, you know, they discovered where it was just tungsten before, they discovered gold, rhenium, thulium, europium, and beryllium, along with little potassium. So that was, you know, mankind's, you know, dream to turn baser metals
So you proved alchemy, or that experiment proved alchemy to be viable, really, something that can happen. It did happen.
Yes.
Why didn't we hear about this? This is astonishing, really.
Yes, it's the way, you know, it's science is pretty obscure, especially a lot of researchers, and it's just that, I mean, I was a researcher, so I found it, But yeah, that just wasn't. This is kind of the stuff that's been suppressed. The whole fusion, cold fusion, low energy fusion thing has been suppressed. And there's the best book, 500 pages, but it's the best book about fusion and how it's been suppressed and all that kind of stuff. Is called Fusion Fiasco by Stephen D. Krivit. And you can get that on Amazon.
Spell his last name. Spell his last name.
His last is K-R-I-V-I-T.
Okay, Krivit.
And it's called Fusion Fiasco. He has actually several other books on fusion. And he is the world's most investigative reporter about alternative fusion energies, Lenner or cold fusion or whatever you want to call them. I guess Moxie fusion now. But what's the thing about this is, you know, Carrillo and Iorio did it, but they used kind of a primitive process. But if you were to do the same process that Osawa and Kushi did, they basically used the power supply from a sodium street lamp, right? And, you know, you see, look, go out now and you get all these LED street lamps, right? Well, the old power supply for the they have warehouses and warehouses full of old sodium street lamp power supplies. So you can get them for nothing. You basically build your own ceramic bulb, you know, stuff it full of tungsten oxide, pressurize it with argon, because when with the presence of the argon moderator, it drives the Moxie fusion process 10,000-fold. And and turn it on, and you know, Osawa and Kushi just took them a few hours to turn the sodium oxide into potassium, and it's only going to take a few hours for you to turn the tungsten oxide into gold and rhenium.
Now, wait. This is really amazing. Now, if that gold was really produced by we'll call it alchemical modalities, how much gold was produced? Can it be determined to be different than we'll call it organic gold, for the lack of a better term? Is it the same as what we dig out of the ground or pan out of a stream?
It's exactly gold. The same stuff. Yeah, it's electron microscopy.
Okay.
They shined it in there, gives out frequencies, and yeah, there was gold, there was rhenium, there was thulium, europium, there was beryllium.
I gotcha. I gotcha. Yeah.
Oh, but there's another thing. See, one of the things about the whole Moxie fusion is, it's like there's a layer, the seventh layer atomic shell layer, electron shell layer, is the actinides. And that's things like thorium and uranium. And actually, there was a Dr. Robert Bass who was doing his own kind of fusion thing. And he basically took 1/10 of a gram of thorium, and he converted it into unique copper and titanium non-radioactive alloy isotopes, and he only used 300 watts, and he was 90% efficient. So if you extrapolate that to fusing gold, it basically, all your costs, tungsten oxide, the argon, and the electricity would be about $60 to fuse an ounce of tungsten oxide into an ounce of gold.
Why aren't people doing this?
Well, I don't know, but, you know,
an ounce of gold is not cheap now. It's bringing a pretty good.
And you can build the machine. You can build the machines. I mean, Socha Group built a machine kind of some ours just to prove the concept. But, you know, there's a whole warehouses full of sodium streetlight power supplies. They're power supply. And you build your own little ceramic bulbs, and, you know, away you go. And also, you can use different elements. You can also make all the platinum group metals. There's another metal oxide you can use to make the platinum group metals. And so, why isn't this happening? It'd be a lot easier and cheaper to fuse Moxie fuse gold than it would be to mine Bitcoin.
I would think that it's probably being done then, but nobody's advertising it. Why would they? They wouldn't want to.
Yeah, exactly. So. Well, you know, we could talk about what's we'll keep it. We'll keep it in more into the science stream and narrow on this one.
Okay.
But probably it's something we might go talk about Stanley Meyer in his water car.
Yeah, let's get to
Stanley Meyer.
We could also talk about Fleischmann and Pons, but let's do Stanley Meyer first, because everybody, I think, most people remember Stanley Meyer. Obviously murdered by the government because of what he discovered. Although what he discovered isn't exactly the way most people think about it. So there's a whole story here. So tell us more about Stanley Meyer, the guy that took tap water, basically treated it, put it in his dune buggy through a system of devices, and was able to fuel it. What about Stanley Meyer?
Well, one of the things that we know about how Stanley Meyer died, and then, of course, there's also the story of what happened. Because this, and he wasn't the only one. You know, remember Dr. Stephen Greer? He wanted to buy all of Stanley equipment and do an open source research group where, you know, there'd be live TV cameras watching, you know, you could watch online them doing the experiments. But his group didn't have enough money, and so some British investor bought all of Stanley Meyer's stuff. And like Dr. Greer, you can actually go online and see Dr. Greer talking about this, but he got a call from the British investor saying, you know, the last surviving guy that was doing the research had called him in desperation, and all the other guys had been killed. And this guy was running for his life, and Stephen Greer, you know, Stephen Greer never really heard from any of those guys ever again.
And, this is Dr. Stephen Greer, the UFO research guy.
Yeah, the UFO, okay. And also the energy guy. He has most of the things about trying to get humanity free. And so, you know, all of his materials. But, you know, one of the things is I knew one of the guys that worked with Stanley Meyer when he was running that dune buggy over Unity, and he told me the secret that Stanley Meyer was doing. He didn't know anything about Moxie that made Stanley Meyer's vehicle over Unity.
Okay.
And what it was, when Stanley Meyer, if you look at the videos when Stanley Meyer was, you know, doing the over Unity dune buggy, because he was making basically deuterium, he was making like HHO, or in this case, he when he ran the car, he was using heavy water, deuterium oxide, which is what we use in our reactor, was using argon as the non-combustible gas. And if you look at the video when it's over Unity, you'll notice there's a big tank in the back seat of the dune buggy. And that is the argon tank. And normally, if you had an HHO system, or in his Stanley Meyer's a deuterium O system, it would, you know, you're basically, because it takes about 9 electron volts to break water into oxygen and, you know, hydrogen. And then when you burn it, you get 9 volts back. So basically, where are you going to get the extra energy? It'd have to come out of the battery. So, you know, if you only got one battery in the car, after a little while, it's just going to run out of energy and the car stops. But Stanley Meyer's car would kept driving and driving and driving way longer than there could ever be energy coming out of the battery, and nobody could figure out. Well, what it was, he was basically, you know, you have deuterium oxide, you have an argon atmosphere, you have an electrical discharge inside the combustion chambers of the vehicle, and as long as the argon was flowing, the car was over Unity, and when it ran out of argon, well, then it stopped being over Unity, and the battery discharged. So Stanley So Stanley basically converted, you know, an internal combustion engine into a MOXIE fusion reactor. And how you can get over Unity is because when you're doing like oxygen hydrogen burning or deuterium oxygen burning, you're getting about 9 electron volts out. But if you do a MOXIE process, you're getting something upwards of 70 to 200,000 electron volts out. So that's thousands of times. Why, if you do a MOXIE process, it produces that extra heat that, you know, allowed those cylinders to run. And really, he did it in a vehicle, and, you know, when the argon ran out, well, that was the end of the over Unity. Now, if he had done something like taken an internal combustion engine that was attached to a generator, and then out of the exhaust pipe, he put it into a condenser. And in the condenser, you know, basically all you've got is heavy water vapor and argon gas. And in the condenser, the heavy water vapor would condense back into heavy water, which would then be used in Stanley Meyer's fuel injection, heavy water fuel injections. And then the argon would just go back into the intake, and you just basically close loop the system. Now you've got a MOXIE fusion reactor that can power your house, your business, you know, a boat, a train, or anything else you want.
Well, I think, all of you listening who don't know, Stanley Meyer was contacted by the U.S. Department of Defense. The Pentagon sent some people out there to meet him and to see his dune buggy and so forth. And they basically came away with the idea that they wanted that technology for the military. That's the story, anyhow. Tell us the rest of that story, if you know it. I'm sure you do.
Well, he went to meet two mysterious guys from Belgium, from NATO. And he went to a Cracker Barrel. Yeah, but okay. This was the one where he died. Yeah, and he basically sat down, was eating with the Cracker Barrel, and then he was there. He had a twin brother that did the electronics with him. And then Stanley Meyer jumped up. He said, "I've been poisoned." He ran out into the parking lot, and he basically died. He died, you know, saying, "I've been poisoned." And then, you know, the two guys that they're doing dinner with, lunch with or whatever, doing a deal, right, they just kind of disappeared. And of course, you know, that could be one fluke. But the fact that British investor bought, you know, all of Stanley Meyer stuff and got a research group together and they were doing research on it and now they're all dead too, well, that's a little suspicious.
The interesting angle here is that Stephen Greer was involved with this too, to a tangential degree. And there's a video up about that online. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, he's the one that gave the story to us because he knew the British investor and he knew some of the researchers that were going to do this. And he warned them, but they didn't listen. And so that's one of the reasons why I'd like people to download the paper and just kind of give this away because, you know, Stanley Meyer was really secretive. He wouldn't tell anyone, when my car was over Unity, I was using heavy water, which is deuterium oxide, which is what we use in our reactor, and argon gas, which is the moderator we use in our MOXIE fusion reactor. And then there's electric discharge, which we use in our fusion reactor. So basically, mm-hmm. turn the internal. So, you know, if you try to keep that secretive, well, then, you know, you end up in a box. So my thing is just to give it away to everybody. You can do it. You know, this is something that anybody, anywhere, even anywhere in the third world, I mean, a good auto mechanic and electrical guy could easily put together one of these and could easily convert an internal combustion engine. And by the way, all of Stanley Meyer's patents, one of the things, if you have a regular HHO cell, it's basically electrolysis. And the problem with that is because it's electrolysis always makes the hydrogen come out before the deuterium comes out, right? So all the deuterium will stay in the HHO cell. It will never come out to go in your typical HHO vehicle. That's why Stanley Meyer made fuel injectors. Basically, he put the heavy water, which is deuterium oxide, into these fuel injectors that were hollow with a rod on the inside, and then he hit it with a high-voltage electricity, which turned all the deuterium and oxygen, the heavy water, into deuterium and oxygen gas, DDO gas. And that injected into the cylinders along with a bunch of argon, and then they sparked it off and, you know, like a typical car. And so that was the process. That's why, and you can get up all of Stanley Meyer's patents are online. Uh-huh. You can download them. And so any good mechanic, and there's lots of guys out there that do this, and if they hear what I'm talking about, it isn't too hard. You can buy deuterium oxide, you know, out of any supply store. It's in about one out of every 7,000 molecules of hydrogen in water is deuterium oxide. About 9%, 0.9% of the air is argon. So, you know, basically the oceans and your rivers and the rainwater is a fuel source, and the moderator is in the air, so there's really no way to blockade this. There's no way to put sanctions on it, and this is not free energy, but it's a harvestable energy source that basically anybody or any nation can tap into. So this is really like the second occurrence of fire. You know, we don't know where original fire came, where we burnt, you know, hydrogen or carbon with oxygen. Well, now this is kind of a second type of fire where we literally MOXIE fuse, you know, metal oxides with oxygen. In this case, they were doing deuterium with oxygen, but, you know, you could do tungsten and oxygen and make, you know, precious metals or zirconium, hafnium oxide with, you know, and make basically all the platinum group metals. And so this is something you can do. And, you know, rather than try to keep it all secret and end up in a box, it's probably best just to give this technology to anyone who's listening. You can download the paper. You can look at the references. You can do your own research, and you can do this yourself. You don't need billions of dollars and take dozens of years. This is something achievable by, you know, smart people that work hard.
Okay, very interesting. Now, for those of you who are not scientifically oriented, the Stanley Meyer story in and of itself, from what you've just heard, is well worth a look-see. And if you go to, I guess, YouTube, you can find videos about Stanley Meyer. You can probably find the one with Stanley himself on there explaining basically, but not completely, about how his dune buggy ran. This is a big story. Yeah. Big story. Under Ken's name, I'm going to be putting, in a little bit, I'm going to be putting four links for you. The MOXIE fusion paper that we've alluded to, people who are doing the same kind of thing that Ken is doing, Stanley Meyer's patents, and Stanley Meyer's history. So they'll all be there within a couple of 3 hours under Ken's name and guess. Okay, Ken, go ahead.
Yeah, there's actually a Stanley Meyer video which was filmed in Colorado Springs, not too far from where I live. And he actually talks about, he knew that he was doing an atomic process like MOXIE. So if you can get that talk that was done in the 1990s, he kind of spills all the beans there. If you know what I've been talking about and then you listen to what he says, he knew what he was doing. He just was very secretive about things. Look what happened to him.
Wow. All right, this is interesting. And the idea that trying to make money on it is what can do people in real quick. You've got a vision here of the big picture. You want to get this out and walk away from it, so to speak.
Yeah, but
I had two guys. Go ahead.
MOXIE fusion can be dangerous. And pretty much every researcher I mentioned here had very shortened lives.
Really?
And it was because MOXIE fusion is dangerous, yes. And this is where we can probably talk about Fleischmann and Pons.
Okay, go ahead.
And why Fleischmann is dead and Pons is still alive. And, okay, so some of you remember, like, it was 1989, Fleischmann and Pons announced the cold fusion discovery in the University of Utah.
It was a big controversy. That's right. Yeah, big controversy.
Yeah. Oh, they were brutally suppressed because they were challenging, you know, orthodox science. And they really had something because they were getting extra heat. By the way, other people did their same experiments, and they also got extra heat and discovered things like helium-4. Right? Mm-hmm. And so they were thinking, what's happening? They had electrolytic cells, basically platinum electrodes. They would electrolyze heavy water. You know, I just like MOXIE. And, you know, some deuterium would come out and the oxygen would come out. What they were doing is they thought that the hydrogen would pack in the palladium electrodes. And then somewhere in the palladium electrodes, the deuterium, the two deuteriums would fuse together to make helium, and that would be releasing heat. But unfortunately, what really was happening is the palladium, in their case, was fusing with oxygen and making a radioactive xenon gas, which then would vent into the laboratory space, which they would breathe. And this was actually confirmed with if you go to like page 9 on the paper. There was another guy. He had his own electrolysis cells. He was using platinum electrodes. And what he did is, you guys probably have measured, radon in your basement. And if you, you open it.
Yeah,
up,
sure.
Yeah. Well, inside that can is a thing called a CR39. It's a Colombian resin 39. And when a alpha particle, if the radon decays, it releases an alpha particle. And if the alpha particles is within, you know, a few millimeters of that chip. It's a very tiny chip, and it's the argon and the alpha particles coming out the way punches like a little hole in that chip, and then you dip the chip in hot sodium hydroxide, and it'll actually make a little pit you can see. And so basically, this guy put a bunch of those, four of those CR39 chips above one of those electrolysis cells, the platinum electrode. And after he ran it for a day or two, and then he pulled the chips out and examined them, and they were just completely pockmarked with little pits, which means, and if you take platinum and you fuse it with oxygen, that makes radon, a bunch of different, because platinum has several different isotopes, so it's going to make a whole bunch of different radon types. And they decayed, and so basically when you're doing that type of cold fusion electrolysis cell, you're basically turning that laboratory air into something hundreds of times worse than your worst radon basement. When the controversy came on, like Pons, he was French. He just went
We have about 60 seconds max. Go ahead. That's it.
Late. So basically, they basically Madame Curie'd themselves. But, download the paper, read it.
Yeah, download the paper, read it. If you have an interest in this, you can do it yourself, apparently. And what I'm hearing, if I can summarize this in layman's terms, is that there is now a way to achieve alchemy and over unity that is available to virtually anyone who wants to do it.
Yes.
Wow.
And it's been going on for decades. It's just many decades. It's just now, now you can read about it in a in a good document. And then, we did it. The Scotra group did it. And, pretty much anybody else can do it, too, if they, put the time and energy and thought into it.
All right. Wow. All right. Well, that's a very interesting tour of a fascinating field, cold fusion, overunity, and alchemy. This is remarkable. Thank you, Ken. That was really interesting, truly.
You're welcome, and I hope your listeners make good use of it.
All right. Thanks very much for the kind, altruistic motivation as well. That's not common enough these days. Take care of yourself, Ken. Thanks.
Yes.
All right. Good night. Okay. Dr. Stephen Greer, Stanley Meyer, a lot of, unfortunately, dead people. Alchemy, gold, overunity.